Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When a tornado looms, most of us want to be far away. Adam Houston wants to be right there.
They're fascinating, for one. They're as fascinating as they are destructive.
Adam is a professor of earth and atmospheric sciences at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he's trying to figure out what the exact conditions are that lead to the formation of tornadoes, something that's not yet understood. In May of this year, Adam and his team were in northwestern Texas, tracking a powerful thunderstorm, a supercell, the kind that could generate a tornado. Their radar instruments were ready, drones positioned to fly into the storm, but then it looked like the storm was changing. There wasn't going to be a tornado.
So we backed off, and as we did, the storm evolved through mergers of multiple storms and became very strong very quickly.
They raced to get ahead of the storm.
There was a tremendous amount of dust, partly because of the drought conditions in West Texas that led to very poor visibility. It was kind of thrilling to be in a situation where you get to zero visibility because of blowing dust. Of course, very dangerous.
Then the tornado formed.
We are in great position, so we think we collected pretty good data. And then as the storm continued to evolve, we continued to target it and hopefully get, and we'll find out once we put all the data together, got an interesting data set that could be used to better understand what happened.
The data Adam's team collected that day could be a game changer in better predicting tornadoes. Right now, scientists understand only the general conditions that lead to them, like a powerful storm and wind shear, a change in wind speed and direction with height.
But there's a lot of stuff that's happening that can either disrupt that. So that is, we have the vertical wind shear in the lowest levels, it's oriented in the right way, no tornado forms. That's one of the mysteries we're trying to understand. What is that disruption?
And Adam says if we can better predict which supercells will generate tornadoes, it could save lives.
You can't move your house, you can't move your crops, but people can protect themselves. They can, with enough advance notice, get to shelter. And so the aim is, you know, for a lot of our work is to improve understanding, improve ultimately forecasting so that people can protect themselves when tornadoes occur.
The stakes for accurate forecasts are higher these days. With more extreme weather events, it can mean the difference between life and death. On this episode, what scientists are learning about predicting extreme weather, and also about how to deliver their messages in a way that will compel people to act. Then a look at what happens after a storm hits, when the hard work of recovery begins. If you look up what the weather is going to be like, you'll see a prediction of what's coming your way. Rain, clouds, sunshine. But what you don't see are all of the calculations that went into making those predictions. Math and meteorology go hand in hand. But this approach is still fairly new, and it took a while to catch on. Jad Slaman has this story on a game-changing forecast when meteorologists crunched the numbers to predict the blizzard of 93.
Well, there's not only the snow that's coming down, but there's some high winds that are mixed with it, creating visibility problems at times you can barely see right in front of you.
It was the storm of the century, a blizzard that affected a full 40% of the American population, stretching from Florida up to New England. The blizzard of 93, as it's known, broke records for snowfall and for cold. I was in West Virginia and 4 years old at the time. I remember snowdrifts taller than I was. Louis W. Uccellini, on the other hand, was chief of the National Weather Service's Meteorological Operations Division. He and his team were at work, hunkered down for what they knew would be a big one.
There were people who slept in the offices. Let's just put it that way.
Louis has been fascinated by storms as long as he can remember, from his childhood days in Long Island.
I've been told by my parents when they were alive that even before I talked, I was pointing up at clouds and apparently getting excited about falling snow around me. And, you know, grew up in an area on Long Island where when you did get a snowstorm, you tended to get the big ones. And to watch the world basically change in front of your eyes and that everything being white, it was just a really exciting thing to grow up in.
He grew up to eventually become the director of the National Weather Service. The same snowstorms that dazzled him as a kid confounded his colleagues in adulthood.
I've visited over 100 offices. And what was interesting to me is that those offices in the northern part of the country, in Alaska, they would tell you that the hardest forecast problem they had was snow. And that it was harder to forecast snow in their area than any place else. You would hear that almost uniformly.
He says snowfall is especially difficult to predict accurately because you have to factor in variables that cause precipitation and then other variables that determine whether or not it's going to be frozen by the time it hits the ground. There's also the question of how frozen. Is it fluffy snow, wet snow? Does it stick? All of that changes how many inches you get. Louis tells me there's more to meteorology than a guy in a suit pointing to rain clouds on a map and cracking jokes with the morning news anchors.
You know, meteorology is basically the study of the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is a continuous fluid.
So a meteorologist, he says, is a physicist and a chemist and a pretty hardcore mathematician.
In a very real sense, it's applied mathematics in terms of understanding how the atmosphere works, and then how to set up the equations and discretize those equations for computers to predict the future. Using all those equations that describe the atmosphere, you can actually set them up as an initial value problem. So if you initialize those equations, you can actually set them up in a way that you can step forward in time.
Using math in this attempt to step forward in time to predict the future, it's commonplace now, but the idea was off to a slow start in the early days of meteorology, in more ways than one. Louis tells me about an American team that tried a math-based approach to modeling a storm in 1950 using early computing.
By 1952, they had a prediction for it.
So, 2 years after the storm had happened, better late than never. But even though this project showed many meteorologists that math could predict the weather, the idea remained controversial.
In the mid-1970s, there were noted meteorologists. They literally published papers that said, abandon all attempts to use models as a representation of the atmosphere. And I think, you know, basically throwing their hands up in frustration.
The competing school of thought was basically pattern recognition, looking at past storms for clues to upcoming ones.
This is what happened when that pattern existed in three different storms over the last 50 years that I've been doing this. So this is what I expect to happen over the next 2 days with this storm, right? So they call that basically an analog case study approach. And it is subjective. It's done in a way based on the experience of a particular person.
The math and modeling school of meteorology held on to their convictions, and over the years, a number of developments would prove their method possible.
But by the 70s and the 80s, we were getting bigger computers, we were getting more global observations.
They had the ability to crunch more numbers, and they were getting better numbers. These global observations were important, Louis says, because the atmosphere is continuous. It's one thing. Conditions on the other side of the world affect what happens in your backyard.
We're simulating the atmosphere and allowing the atmosphere to move as it will based on the nature of the temperature, pressure, and moisture.
Over the decades, the storm forecast crept forward, 2 days in advance, then three by the late 80s. By the time the blizzard of 93 came around, Louis and his colleagues were confident that their model was showing them a big one was on the way.
And this one model, the MRF, was just moving it right up, you know, developing it along the southeast coast of the U.S. and moving it right up the coast. and producing a major snowstorm.
They were confident in the math, in the physics, and in the computing, about as confident as someone can be when it comes to predicting the weather.
We were. You're always nervous. You know, you don't verify a forecast with a forecast, right? And there are still, you know, things that the atmosphere can do that aren't captured by a discretized numerical modeling system. You know, the atmosphere is still a continuous fluid that can throw some curveballs at you even 24 hours in advance.
Louis and his Weather Service colleagues reached out to the rest of the government. They said, hey, our model is saying a big one is coming, and we're pretty sure it's right.
So Friday afternoon, as the storm was developing, I did an interview for CBS, and I said, this has the potential to be the most extreme non-tropical event to hit the eastern U.S.
Perhaps even more unpredictable than the weather, Louis had no idea what state and local leaders would decide to do with that warning. Their response is actually one of the biggest surprises Louis remembers from this whole episode. They listened, like really listened.
And, you know, you have newspaper headlines coming out of Boston, you know, brace yourself. The day before, they canceled the St. Patrick's Day parade the day before. States were declaring states of emergency for their major road systems the day before snow had even started falling from this storm.
Predicting this storm so far in advance isn't like predicting the path of a hurricane that's already churning across some ocean. The blizzard of 93 didn't exist when the warning went out. Louis and his colleagues were asking state and local leaders to look out into clear skies, to stand in calm winds, and believe that the big one was coming. The fact that they did likely saved countless lives.
They were declaring states of emergency. New York State for the thruway, and Virginia and Pennsylvania. They were all way ahead in terms of preparing for and responding to the storm to mitigate its impact before the first flake of snow was even falling from this storm.
And then it hit.
Reported by Garrett Utley. Good evening. It stretches for 2,100 miles from the Gulf of Mexico to New England. It's caused at least 15 deaths. Technically, it is not a hurricane, but in some areas you wouldn't know the difference. Torrential rains, heavy snow, high tides, and devastating winds. That is what is hitting the East Coast this evening. We begin our reports with
the model, the prediction. It was all vindication for meteorologists of Louis' generation. Just 90 years earlier, leading scientists had been arguing that meteorology was a pseudoscience. Just 20 years earlier, the naysayers contended that the math was impossible. Don't even try. Louis' crew did, and they succeeded.
That really represented a defining moment of all that work. In my opinion, of all that work that occurred up to this time by hundreds of people, thousands of people around the world to really make this moment happen. And now we see, since this particular storm and this particular forecast, the use of numerical models is sort of like part of the whole, you know, discussion of an ongoing storm, ongoing hurricane, whatever. You know, the models are noted. I think people understand that there is science and technology and mathematics behind what we're doing now.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Weather forecasts have become a lot more accurate over the years. For example, people now have a few days' warning when a hurricane is approaching. A better forecast is one thing, but actually getting people to act on this information is another. As severe weather becomes more common due to climate change and more dangerous to public safety, meteorologists are considering how to better communicate the risks to the public. Reporter Carrie Sheridan recently lived through Hurricane Ian, a massive and deadly Category 4 storm that hit southwest Florida in September. She has this story about how some meteorologists are changing the way they deliver their messages.
3 days before Hurricane Ian made landfall, on a Sunday, I was assigned to go to some grocery stores in Sarasota to see how people were preparing.
I'm a reporter. I'm reporting on storm coverage. And I was wondering if I could ask you, have you bought some stuff for this storm today?
Actually not. We're just buying regular stuff because we saw it's really not going to affect us that much. So,
Okay.
So we really didn't do anything.
That's Marie Amos shopping with her husband Greg outside of Winn-Dixie. And that's what I heard again and again. People told me they were just doing their regular shopping.
It looks like you got some water. Are you preparing for the storm?
No, not really.
Oh, no.
I'm not even thinking about it.
Nobody seemed especially worried, even though for at least the last 5 days, weather forecasts had shown the potential of a direct hit to our area in central to southwest Florida. Sarasota, where I talked to these shoppers, was in what forecasters call the cone of uncertainty. It's a shape-shifting image, picture like a squiggly tadpole. It represents the forecaster's best prediction of where the storm will likely hit.
The western edge of Florida, near Mobile, Alabama, all the way down close to Fort Myers. That's a wide territory that could see landfall. We still don't know.
3 days before Ian hit, the cone was huge. Hurricane Ian ended up making landfall at the very southern edge of that cone. It was among the most powerful storms to ever hit Florida, a Category 4 hurricane with wind speeds of 150 miles per hour. The death toll so far is more than 100. That's 10 times higher than Charley, another Category 4 storm that followed a similar path in 2004.
One was a 57-year-old woman. For her, the roof caved in while she was in the home during the storm.
That's Russell Vega, medical examiner in Sarasota. Many of the storm's victims were in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. Many drowned. Some were found clinging to debris.
While we consider all these deaths preventable, some of them were likely inevitable, but I do think that we need to view all of them as things that we could do better and improve on, and whether that's communication or whether it's earlier communication, more accurate communication, I don't know.
Making sure people understand the forecasts and heed the warnings is a problem that meteorologists and social scientists have been working on for years.
Because we could have the perfect forecast from a modeling perspective or from a weather forecasting perspective, but if people didn't get the information, they weren't available to hear it, or they heard it and misconsumed it, was it a good forecast?
That's Marshall Shepard, director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia and a former president of the American Meteorological Society. He says, for starters, the cone of uncertainty is hard for people to wrap their heads around.
What we know is that many people misunderstand that cone. They believe that it means the center of the cone is where the storm is going. There tends to be a focus on the line or the little dots in the center of the cone. But in fact, what the cone is suggesting is that there's a 2 out of 3 chance that anywhere in that cone, the center of the storm will be.
Marshall says that's not easy to grasp for many people.
The public struggles with things like probability. We see that in just a percent chance of rain forecast. Many people struggle with what that actually means for them.
Marshall also says people often base their decisions on previous experiences, other storms they've lived through. But with more extreme weather due to climate change, that's not a good way to go.
This idea that I've lived through storms like this before, what I call normalcy bias or optimism bias, just doesn't apply. We have to really convey in risk communication that as we see more anomalously strong hurricanes or extreme events, in part due to climate change, your past experience is not a reference point for something that's an anomaly.
Some people have criticized weather forecasters for not translating weather risks into terms viewers and listeners can understand. Marshall thinks the burden is on the public to change.
You know, I don't think the meteorologists need to. I think we need to train on the other end of the spectrum. I think we need to train the public and policymakers on how to consume this information better.
On that point, Susan Jocelyn, a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, disagrees.
For a number of reasons, that isn't a good solution. People can absorb and use information as long as it's tailored to how they're thinking about it and their decisions.
Susan studies the way people make choices when given weather information, to evacuate or not, to cover plants if there's a chance of a freeze, things like that. Susan says people can handle more complexity than they're given credit for. For instance, when weather forecasters acknowledge the degree of uncertainty in the forecast, she says her experiments show that's good. It actually builds trust. She says it's also best to keep the message direct, simple, and specific.
So if, for instance, someone is concerned about temperatures falling below freezing, there's something they're going to do to their plants or something if it falls below freezing, it's important to say that there's a 10% chance that the temperatures will be below freezing instead of there's a 90% chance it'll be above freezing.
But being very direct and clear doesn't always get results. Take the case of Hurricane Ike, which hit Galveston, Texas in 2008.
More than 140,000 coastal residents in Ike's path didn't evacuate, despite authorities warning them that they faced certain death. 37 people are known.
After hearing that so many Texans defied the National Weather Service's warning of certain death if they stayed, Rebecca Morse, a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, wanted to find out why.
And so we went down to Galveston and that area and talked to people who had evacuated, who'd been flooded, who hadn't evacuated. And we learned about all the complexities of how people interpret the information. For some people, that message was really compelling and it made them want to evacuate, or it helped them motivate a family member to evacuate. For some people, they really wanted to defy the message and stay and show that the information was wrong.
So how do you convince people who may just think they know better or may resist being told what to do? Rebecca has a PhD in atmospheric science, and she's been focusing on the psychology of storm communication for the past 20 years. She says this is a growing field.
Of course, there's a loss of life and the damage, and there's also the trauma, you know, the trauma people experience of what is it like to be in your house and think you're going to die, and, you know, it's just horrible. And we can't stop the hurricanes, but my hope is that by improving the science and then improving how that science is communicated, we can help them know what they're trying to avoid so that they can make the best decisions for themselves.
It's an effort that's happening around the world. The UK's National Weather Service, the Meteorological Office, recently hired its first socio-meteorologist, Helen Roberts.
When we're forecasting the weather, we're not doing it just for the sake of understanding the future state of the atmosphere. It's all about how it impacts people. We often say we want to tell people what the weather will do, not what the weather will be.
She says research in the UK has shown it's useful to outline easy steps people can take. So if preparing for a power outage, get out a flashlight, or as she calls it, a torch.
The insight here is put the easiest first. Put the torch at the top. Most people can quite easily locate a torch. And the reason for doing that is that if you put the most difficult first, people will often not do anything. They'll go, that's too difficult, can't be bothered, don't know where to go, so not do any of it.
Severe heat warnings are a relatively new phenomenon in Europe, and there, Helen has another tip.
It's really useful to frame the action statement in terms of helping somebody else. So, for example, suggesting that you check in on an elderly relative or neighbour.
Then add specific actions to take, like make sure they drink plenty of water, keep their blinds closed during the day.
And what they found was not only was that much more likely that people would take the advice and do those behaviours, but there was a double win whereby because they'd already done it on behalf of someone else, they were then more likely to do it for themselves as well.
Helen says they're also taking the message to where people are on social media these days, like TikTok.
They issued a rare red warning for Storm Eunice, which hits the UK on Friday.
There are no fancy graphics, no dancing, just a close-up of a young man talking over a simple map with zones at risk colored in yellow, orange, and red.
In the amber warning area, there's the risk of 70 and in some places 80 mile per hour wind gusts. This would lead to widespread disruption to power supplies as well as transport, and these would be damaging winds for trees and for buildings.
And a clear explanation of what the weather will do and how it will affect people's lives. It's the direction of the future in forecasting. For The Pulse, I'm Carrie Sheridan.
Coming up, we'll turn to the aftermath of storms. What are communities learning about being better prepared for emergency situations, especially when it comes to protecting the most vulnerable people?
is this going to be my story? I'm going to have survived being on dialysis for this long, and now I'm going to die because of a winter storm. Like, is this literally how the story ends?
That's next on The Pulse.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about extreme weather. So far, we've explored predicting storms. Now, let's turn to their aftermath. When conditions get dangerous, when the power grid fails, it's often the most vulnerable, people who are elderly or have serious illnesses, who are most at risk. When power and water were out for millions of Texans after an unexpected major snowstorm hit the state in 2021, thousands of dialysis patients were left in the lurch. They were stranded in their homes, often with nowhere to turn, as a deadly buildup of toxins flowed through their blood that would otherwise be removed by dialysis machines. Reporter Sarah Willa Ernst has this story on what happened and how the state is trying to prepare better for future storms.
For the last 19 years, Melissa Bensuda hasn't really gotten many good nights of sleep.
Now that the machine has finished its testing process, it's now indicating that the machine is safe to use, and I will click out of the alarm notification.
That's when she started doing dialysis at home because of end-stage kidney disease. She hooks up to a machine when she's ready to go to sleep for 8 hours a night, one of the few patients to do the treatment at home.
And now I am prepared to dialyze. So I will get my needles out, sterilize my fistula, stick my needles, and connect to the machine.
Every other night, she sticks two 15-gauge needles into her arm, one to draw the blood out of her body, one to pump it back in. To give you a sense of size, that's around 3 times as big as the needle used for a flu shot. The machine whirring in the background, it's something she's used to at this point, but
you never quite get the deepest sleep on dialysis.
One night in the middle of treatment last February, Melissa jolted awake. Her dialysis machine made one long, loud beep, and then silence. The power was out, and was still out the next morning.
That's when I started to panic.
For 4 days, she had no electricity.
I had no idea what was in store for me and my family that week.
Melissa lives in Pflugerville, Texas, a suburb right outside of Austin. Much of the area, actually much of the whole state, lost power and water for days. Dialysis machines, of course, need power to run, but also water. Lots and lots of water. The kind of treatment done at dialysis centers need 40 gallons. You can think of that as a standard bathtub filled up to the brim. According to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, about half of the dialysis centers in Texas closed their doors. Others cut back operations. The system of getting patients dialysis, whether at a center where the majority of patients go, or at home, was essentially at a standstill.
Clearly, the best laid plans were not sufficient.
Don Maloney is a physician and kidney disease expert at McGovern Medical School in Houston. In the wake of the storm, he was triaging desperate and panicked dialysis patients who turned up at the ER. Emergency rooms across the state were some of the only places running with backup power and water. And soon they became overwhelmed by dialysis patients seeking treatment. But hospitals aren't set up to provide dialysis care on a large scale. They might have a handful of machines, but usually dialysis is done in outpatient settings. Houston Methodist Hospital had one of those overwhelmed ERs. Roberta Schwartz, the executive vice president, oversaw the response.
The amount of people who desperately need to get in to get those treatments lined up down the hallway and around the corner.
The hospital converted a conference room into a pre-screening center. They increased the number of treatments by 50%, and they cut dialysis treatment time in half to just 2 hours to help more people.
And we just flowed people for 24 hours a day through these dialysis machines.
Don Maloney, who is at the hospital across the street, believes a main tenet of emergency preparedness is to overprepare for the worst and unexpected. And the freeze that hit the state was certainly unexpected.
We're used to a lot of disasters, but people thought, well, it would be like our usual snowstorm where there are a few flakes of snow on the ground and not the kinds of outages and severe disruptions that we did see.
Hurricanes on the Gulf or tornadoes in the plains are the kind of disasters Texas is familiar with. But a freeze like this was something Texans had not dealt with before. On top of the power and water outages, roads were impassable. These conditions left more than 50,000 Texans on dialysis, scrambling for a stopgap. Melissa Bensuda called the dialysis center that oversees her care. The facility flooded after the pipes burst.
I felt like on a deserted island, just about.
Melissa wrapped herself in multiple blankets, tired and cold, and she waited. As a way to limit the toxins in her bloodstream, which dialysis would otherwise remove, she stopped eating and drinking.
But I felt completely underserved and neglected. And I'd say I'm probably one of the more resourceful dialysis patients just because of my background with home dialysis and things like that.
But by day two, the toxins started to build up and really affect her. She had nausea and brain fog. Her daughter and granddaughter were with her in the house. They got invited to a friend's house who had power, but Melissa stayed behind. She felt too weak to leave. Plus, there was no way to take the dialysis machine with her.
And I was so grateful that my daughter's friend's power came back on because I really didn't want my children to see me in those last 2 days suffering. I was starting to really have visible signs of fear and losing hope.
This kind of fear was something Austin Peel saw firsthand during the freeze. At the time, he was a paramedic with Austin Travis County EMS. He's from the East Coast, where snowplows and salted streets are the winter way of life. He was really surprised to see the road conditions.
It was just hard, thick ice on the ground that wasn't melting.
He said the ambulances on those first days were the only snowplows on the road, pushing away fresh snow by the vehicle's sheer force and weight. And as the storm continued, the 911 calls from dialysis patients poured in.
The medical directors, along with the hospital, quickly identified that this was something that would end up becoming a massive disaster for hemodialysis patients if not acted upon when they did.
Jason Pickett was one of those medical directors. He was worried about patients without their dialysis facing an electrolyte imbalance, particularly a buildup of potassium in the blood. This can lead to an irregular heartbeat. It can be fatal.
A lot of it came to game time decisions.
Jason and his colleagues directed paramedics to offer a medication called K-Exalate to patients. It can remove some potassium from the blood, as well as fluid that would otherwise build up in the lungs and make it hard to breathe.
It is not a replacement for dialysis. And so we were giving this medicine to those dialysis patients, trying to buy them a day or two in the hopes that then those dialysis centers would be up and running again.
The makeshift solution had its own risks. Too little potassium can affect the nerves and muscles in the heart.
However, we know that we are taking a risk by having that patient in the field that's not on cardiac monitoring, that's not in a healthcare setting with nurses that they can identify their symptoms to, that are continuously evaluating them.
But it was a risk-benefit analysis between doing nothing and intervening. Austin Peel, the paramedic, said most of the dialysis patients he treated were in East Austin, where a lot of Black and brown residents live.
The only people I saw that day were people of color.
End-stage renal disease and kidney failure in general is an illness that disproportionately affects Black and Latino Americans. The leading causes are untreated chronic conditions, particularly high blood pressure and diabetes. And that's often due to a lack of health insurance or access to affordable health care. This is not the first disaster in Texas that has left dialysis patients, and especially patients of color, in the lurch. This has also happened during hurricanes.
It's been a known issue. When there's a natural disaster in the past, the end-stage renal disease facilities tend to close because they're just not as hardened as a hospital that's fully integrated into the infrastructure.
Cameron Duncan is with the Texas Hospital Association. He's one of the lobbyists who helped write a Texas Senate bill aimed at emergency preparedness. The main goal of the bill, which passed almost unanimously, is to keep dialysis centers open during storms and prevent hospital emergency rooms from getting overwhelmed again. While the winter storm was a major wake-up call for lawmakers, this plan really is more about common disasters like hurricanes.
Again, we realize that the winter storm is at least supposed to be a once-in-a-100-year event. However, a once-a-year event, at least, that we have is a hurricane. And so we really try to think about that, looking more at the known disasters that we're facing.
The law says that dialysis centers will get priority for power and water restoration in the way that hospitals and nursing homes do. And if that plan goes awry, centers are required to have a 24-hour reserve of generated power and potable water. The big dialysis center giants operating in Texas, DaVita and Fresenius, supported this bill. But then there's the matter of enforcement. I posed this question to one of the authors of the bill, House Representative Tom Oliverson, who represents suburbs in Houston. I was looking through the bill, and you know, one thing kind of popped out to me is that there doesn't really seem to be any type of enforcement mechanism. I'm wondering, you know, just how do they know, like, whether compliance is happening or not?
I would say from a legislative perspective, we do kind of trust in them that they're going to do that. It's sort of a trust but verify approach. But yeah, they obviously, you know, we do depend on our state agencies to enforce these things. So I think that's probably a good question for them. You know, how would they verify that?
That state agency in charge is the Texas Health and Human Service Commission, and they haven't indicated that there will be any fines if a center is found out of compliance.
Why isn't there a financial penalty?
That's Tiffany Jones-Smith, president of Texas Kidney Foundation. One of her main concerns is whether dialysis centers will make the changes laid out in the law.
Will they do it? If there's no enforcement, nobody does anything without consequences. And if I'm asking you to do something, if there's no penalty, if you don't do it, how am I to ensure that you're going to do what I asked you to do?
The stakes are high for these patients. Some Texans died from missing their dialysis treatments. For many more, there are significant health consequences from going without. Melissa Bensuda in Pflugerville is back on her nightly at-home dialysis. She's doing better. But she will always remember those scary days of the freeze, where she thought she was going to die.
Man, I've survived a lot of things. I've lost a transplant. I've waited forever to get that. And literally at some point I thought, is this going to be my story? I'm going to have survived being on dialysis for this long and now I'm going to die because of a winter storm. Like, is this literally how the story ends?
That story was reported by Sarah Willa Ernst. She's with Houston Public Media. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about extreme weather and what happens after a disaster strikes. A new podcast called In Deep follows residents in Lake Charles, a small city in southwest Louisiana. The city was pummeled by a Category 4 hurricane in 2020 and then hit a few weeks later by a Category 2 hurricane. Then another blow, the same blizzard that froze Texas in 2021, the one we just heard about, also hit Lake Charles. Consecutive storms and little assistance from FEMA and insurance companies left many in this community with few resources to rebuild their homes. For almost a year, residents lived in and out of hotels, in FEMA trailers, and sometimes on the street or under tarps. Reporter Lauren Rosenthal spent a lot of time in Lake Charles talking to people for the podcast, and I asked her about the impact on residents. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the health fallout or what you noticed in terms of people's mental health. It's one thing to go through a terrible disaster, but then that sense of frustration and having to go it alone,
is a whole other challenge. So what did you see and hear from people?
I know a lot of folks are familiar with the term like resilience, right? And folks' resilience was really taxed by like these repeated storms. A lot of folks told me they were depressed, they were anxious. You know, I met some children who were having a really hard time coping with, you know, big rainfall or thunderstorms, which, you know, those are pretty common in this part of Louisiana. Any type of, you know, severe weather sort of got alarm bells ringing and put people back in that frame of mind of, you know, uh-oh, the next big thing is coming.
And the next big thing did come in the spring of this year, and Lauren was right there when it happened. Another storm hit, and the city flooded. Lauren was in a shelter, and she got a phone call from a woman she had interviewed before.
Because I'm pretty sure this will be the next federally declared disaster because people are getting their homes flooded. Oh, my Jesus.
What was that?
Lightning. The power's out.
Things went from bad to worse, and Lauren covered the aftermath of the flooding in the last episode of her podcast, In Deep. Here's an excerpt.
Driving around the city, we spotted an older guy, trim in his early 60s, walking the perimeter of a small brick house with a tattered blue tarp on the roof. This was the owner, Eli Reynolds.
So can you just describe what we're looking at, where we're measuring the water line?
Okay. I don't have my tape with me, but I guarantee you, that's, I would say, better than 2 foot.
Eli was wearing heavy boots, jeans, and a fluorescent yellow T-shirt. He told me he was a forklift operator for a big company in Lake Charles. He only worked there part-time.
I mean, I'm semi-retired, but we definitely need health care at our age, and we're not old enough to get Social Security or whatever. That means I still gotta do what I gotta do.
Things had been tough for Eli and his wife. They'd been fighting their insurance company over damages from the hurricanes. Their house was still gutted. The roof hadn't even been fixed. In the meantime, everything Eli and his wife owned had been locked in a storage pod here in the driveway. Furniture, photo albums. He peered inside. The sofa was sitting in a puddle of murky brown water. The boxes were soaked and soggy.
We're going to have to throw it all away. Everything is going to have to go.
Eli turned back to me. He didn't seem angry.
When you do this too many times, you just get tired. You get tired. And like I said, this is the third time that we've got to do it again.
They'd had to regroup after one hurricane and then another. They'd had almost nothing left to lose. Now that was gone, too.
We're tired. I'm 61. My wife is a little older than me. So, you know, man, we just can't do what we used to do. So that's the sickening part about it. This was our forever home, where we were going to be, you know. But I don't know. I don't know.
Everyone I talked to in Lake Charles had asked themselves a version of this question. After everything that's happened, should I try to stay here or should I leave? It turned out that wasn't just a personal choice. It was also a matter of public policy. After 4 devastating storms in Lake Charles, the government finally took the plunge.
Demolishing flood-prone homes isn't out of the ordinary for some parts of the country, but it would be something new for the city of Lake Charles.
The state announced a voluntary buyout program. They started offering people money to abandon their homes and move somewhere else. The program targeted a part of town that flooded during the May storm. It also flooded during the hurricanes, and it was likely to flood again. The goal was to tear down homes in that area so the land could be restored to marsh. Marshlands can soak up water and help protect against future flooding. And with fewer homes in the way, there'd also be less damage from the next major storm or flood. This was a formal government program whose purpose was to get people to leave their homes. But that had been happening informally for months. Hundreds of families had already left Lake Charles long before there was a buyout program. 7% of the local population had moved away in a single year, and that was just after the hurricanes. People felt intense pressure to leave.
like Alexis Sheridan.
I think they expect you to relocate, you know, and I feel like not everybody can relocate.
When I'd met Alexis, she was pregnant, bouncing between hotels and sleeping outside. All she'd wanted was a permanent place to live in the city where she'd spent most of her life. Alexis had gone to FEMA, but they said they couldn't help her. She kept searching for housing in Lake Charles on her own, right up until her son was born in the summer of 2021.
Why were you still fighting so hard to stay in Lake Charles?
Because I was born and raised there. I just wanted to stay with what I knew. You know, I wanted to stay where I was and where I knew.
When the baby was just a few days old, Alexis got a lead on an affordable apartment. It was in a totally different city, an hour from Lake Charles, but Alexis couldn't hold out any longer. Her son needed a home. She took the apartment. Alexis and her fiancé are now raising their son together in their new city. They have no plans to return to Lake Charles.
That was an excerpt from the podcast series In Deep, hosted by Lauren Rosenthal. And Lauren told me that the back-to-back nature of severe weather events in the region is changing people's minds on what all of this means. These are people who are used to severe storms, but this is different.
Early on, I think some folks just expected, you know, every generation gets their big one. There has been a category three or four hurricane in this part of Louisiana. Every, you know, 40 to 50 years, folks talked about it as like a generational thing. My grandparents had a major hurricane they lived through. My parents did, and now it's my turn. But just the accumulation of storms and the fact that there was a winter freeze in there and then a historic flood just a few months after that, I mean, it really set people back on their heels. And some folks I talked to who really were reluctant to blame or mention climate change early on, they were changing their tune and acknowledged there has to be something more going on here. You know, I don't understand how this is possible. Otherwise, the city's mayor, who's a young conservative, in the wake of the storms, you know, came out publicly, or in the wake of the flood, came out publicly. And he told a reporter, like, we have to talk about climate change. It's very, very obvious. We can't pretend it's anything else that's behind this. And that was pretty remarkable in a state like Louisiana to see a conservative politician really step up to the plate and acknowledge climate change is a threat here, and it may be influencing storms like this.
That's Lauren Rosenthal. She is a reporter at American Public Media and the host of In Deep, a podcast series about Lake Charles, Louisiana, a city that was hit by three major storms and a historic flood. We'll put a link to the whole series on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.